It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Lawmakers, Governor Evers, and members of his cabinet gathered yesterday at the Capitol for the 20th annual State of the Tribes Address. Forest County Potawatomi Chairman James Crawford delivered this year's speech on behalf of the 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin. He encouraged state lawmakers to follow the example of the tribes and find ways to work together.
We share with one another in our powwows and in our traditions, where we feast together. We bring our drums and sing and dance together. Republicans, Democrats, I ask that you don't forget to find the time to set aside your differences and to not be afraid to reach across the aisle and take purposeful time to feast together, to dance together, and to sing together.
Richard L. Ackley is a retired tribal judge, a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He's with us for a look back at yesterday's address. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Before we get into specifics of this year's address, can you tell us a little bit about the goal of this unique annual event?
I believe over the number of years, it's been almost 20, that the goal is to share with the state of Wisconsin legislature and its elected bodies, the governor, the Supreme Court, and others, the importance of recognizing the sovereignty of each tribe and recognizing the long history of tribes in the state of Wisconsin. The state became a state in 1848, but the tribes have dealt with the federal government for, you know, a couple hundred years, if you want to call it that. But to me, it is a recognition, and one of the governors years ago, one of the governors believed in a government-to-government, an executive order relationship. So to me, this is an ongoing tradition that's really important. A unique factor, one of the tribes is from Michigan, who is part of this Great Lakes Center Tribal Council. He was present. It'd be interesting if a Michigan legislator or a Minnesota legislature, in fact, the lieutenant governor of the state of Minnesota is an enrolled member of a tribe in Minnesota. So to me, it's an ongoing tradition that's so important for the state.
And what stuck out to you about Chairman Crawford's address yesterday?
What really stuck out, it was before Chairman Crawford spoke, the elder, Mr. Shano, spoke about how they have a young elected body of tribal representatives from a Potawatomi. And he spoke about how if you come together, and if you come together and deal with the issues, you have a greater amount of collective strength. But in transition to that, the areas that the Forest County Potawatomi chairperson, Mr. Crawford, presented was issues that reflect the regionalism, I would say, of the North. Like in the case of the healthcare, many of these health clinics serve also tribal and non-tribal people, and they're very comprehensive. If you see that, that's so important. The $60 million impact was because the federal system comes to tribes based upon certain treaty obligations and certain responsibilities. But that's so important. But what I found interesting was sometimes it doesn't have to be as complex. There was one issue about just having tribes having their signs showing their territory. And originally, this was all tribal territory, but that was so interesting because the Muskie capital of Hayward or the cheese, this, but just to show where tribes are, and the elder health food issue was a good one, food sovereignty, the issue on kinship, everyone wants to help to have healthy families. And my 18 years in the court, tribes really try to strive for restorative justice and try to keep the families together. And then the issue of affordable housing in the North, that's an issue that'll be ongoing. But what I found interesting is many of these tribes have clinics, and there was a program where the pharmacists, interns can work in these tribal health clinics. They're very comprehensive. So that's just a quick format, but then the ongoing relationship with the Native issues about missing American women, it's just to have better coordination with the federal, the state, and the Attorney General's office, because to me, everyone is safe when any female is safe, no matter what race, color, or creed.
I want to dig into a couple of the issues you just raised. First of all, that the affordable housing. Now, this is an issue in tribal communities and over most of the state. I want to give a listen to Chairman Crawford talking about affordable housing in particular.
It's difficult to hire a new employee if there is nowhere for them or their family to live in your community. I want to commend the legislature and Governor Evers for taking steps this legislative session to address this problem by enacting a package of bipartisan bills to help expand access to safe, affordable housing for working families.
And Richard, this is something we've talked about on the show a lot in various communities around the state. How big an issue is it in tribal communities in Wisconsin?
It is a very big issue, but the coordination between the federal government, the state, whether it be tax credit options, whether it be either loan options, there needs to be better cooperation. And I don't want to use the word border town or counties, townships, villages, and tribes all want to benefit from the same options. And an affordable housing for all parties just makes these rural communities and also other areas very healthy and very and they can be responsive to employees who want to come and live in the north or live in the areas across the state where there are tribes. And to me, this will be a continued issue, but it's that partnership and that relationship that has to continue. And I was so impressed with what Chairman Crawford stated about tribes are different. We have different languages. We have different jurisdictional issues. The Menominee tribe has a greater federal oversight. I've said before on this program, the other tribes, we have a relationship called Public Law 280, where we had shared tribal jurisdiction. The tribes in the north have great relationships with the state with tribes in Minnesota and Michigan, other tribes. So therefore, there needs to be a better understanding of these kinds of dynamics that take place. And to me, if you can sit down and talk and negotiate and not get so trapped with closed communication, you can move forward.
Talking to Richard Ackley, retired tribal judge, member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, looking at yesterday's State of the Tribes address at the state capitol. Another issue you touched on briefly yesterday, Chairman Crawford thanked the state attorney general's office for its task force on missing and murdered Indigenous women. Can you talk more about the kinds of cooperation you would hope to see to deal with this tragic issue between, again, the state government and tribal governments?
Yeah, and I'll say it in this context. Across the country, whether it be either churches dealing with residential schools, whether it be in Canada, whether it be in any state, tribes need to have the coordination and the cooperation of various agencies. The complexity of federal agencies, from the FBI, Department of Justice. In the old days, they had something in the Department of Justice called community relations specialists. So in some ways, the coordination of all these agencies and enforcement, because I have in my own extended family, either to marriage or friends, people in law enforcement, people in the fire department, other areas. And to me, to provide safe options and to immediately respond to these issues, cooperation is and coordination of these the complexities of these issues, either federal law, state law, tribal law. Years ago, I was in Boston for something called Operation Passport. So these things are as quick as we can get. So in some ways, a form of Amber Alert, if we get these kinds of information quickly, we can resolve these issues quickly too.
Now, Chairman Crawford highlighted a lot of positives from over the last year. As we wrap up, Richard, what do you see as maybe a main challenge right now between tribal governments and Wisconsin state government?
Well, if the state governments can learn from tribes, as I stated in my intro, we have different value systems. We have similar. We care for family. We care for extended family. But what the state needs to do, and I guess I'll echo and repeat what Chairman Crawford said, if you can attend the powwow, if you can dance a little, you can feast together. If the state legislature on both sides of the aisle can feast a little, dance a little, and get along, then they're not going to be boxed into positions that are somewhat polarized, and it doesn't benefit the total citizen or all citizens in the state. So perhaps that's the best takeaway we can take away from this 2024 State of the Tribe Address.
Richard, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Richard Ackley, former tribal judge for the Bad River Ojibwe Nation. He's a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He was with us to talk about yesterday's State of the Tribes address delivered by Forest County Potawatomi Chairman James Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk to a legal scholar about a court ruling in Alabama that says that frozen embryos are considered children and what that could mean for in vitro fertilization and more. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Alabama Supreme Court ruled last week that frozen embryos, like those used in vitro fertilization, are people. The ruling is the result of appeals cases brought by couples whose frozen embryos were destroyed by a hospital patient back in 2020. The court's opinion states that frozen embryos are children, and the couples therefore have the right to file wrongful death suits. Fertility clinics are unsure what to do in the wake of the ruling, which does not specify whether the standard operating procedure for IVF, which includes creating and freezing many embryos, is still legal. Alabama's largest hospital has paused IVF treatments in the meantime, and there are questions about what this means for abortion law and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions, maybe your experiences if you've gone through in vitro fertilization. It's 800-642-1234. Susan Liebel is professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Susan, you've read through the opinion on this case. What leaps out at you?
Well, this is a case about extending constitutional rights to embryos and really about establishing fetal personhood. It's radically Christian, and this should alert all Americans to the power of state courts. The 2022 Supreme Court Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade enabled Alabama's court to radically declare that embryos, some only 8 cells or 1/10 of a millimeter, are people with rights. It's the first ruling of its kind, and it would have, as you said, radical implications for IVF, but also for birth control, rape treatments like Plan B, and the equality of women and all pregnant people. This case is a step towards a constitutional framework that would radically assume that an embryo or fetus is a person and their rights may or must be weighed against other persons, particularly pregnant people, something that Justice Alito called for in his Dobbs opinion.
Alabama's Chief Justice Tom Parker wrote in his opinion, even before birth, all human beings have the image of God and their lives cannot be destroyed without effacing his glory. And the quote there, you just mentioned, Susan, definitely a Christian, a particular variety of Christian take on this. Your thoughts on the role of this particular interpretation of religion in shaping this decision?
Yeah, a lot of the media has presented it as if Chief Justice Parker's decision is the majority decision. It isn't. It is only him speaking for himself, and there are other judges who found it objectionable. But what he is doing is inappropriately relying on Christian religious principles, quoting Thomas Aquinas and John Calvin. The U.S. Constitution's First Amendment prohibits governments from making any law respecting an establishment of religion, but it also prohibits government from unduly favoring one religion. And what Chief Justice Parker is doing is establishing Christianity as the guide for law in Alabama. We've seen groups try to challenge this in Florida. A synagogue sued over Florida law that they believe took away their religious liberty to make decisions that their religion calls for that are different, that don't believe that life begins at conception in the same way. So I think there are establishment of religion issues here and also potentially taking away religious liberty from people who have different beliefs.
Let's bring on a caller. Tim is with us in New Berlin. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yes. My question is, or what I heard just a couple of hours ago on the radio was that the Alabama Attorney General stated that they were not going to prosecute under this Supreme Court, Alabama Supreme Court decision. And does that mean that the threat of prosecution has passed? Does that mean the hospitals in Alabama will say, okay, I guess everything's good and they're going to practice IVF again? Or does that mean like a local DA could just prosecute? Does the decision from the Alabama DOJ change anything, or is the threat still there?
Tim, thanks for the call. Now, I admit I hadn't seen that from Alabama's Department of Justice. What do we know about the current state of in vitro fertilization and how it will be affected in Alabama by this ruling?
It's a great question, Tim. The Alabama Supreme Court ruling hasn't outlawed IVF or made it illegal, but at least three clinics have closed when I last checked because they need to assess their civil and criminal liability based on the ruling. So the attorney general can decide not to prosecute certain crimes, but that is an elected position that will change. And also, these three clinics can't depend upon what he's saying in a speech. These are courts. They've made a decision. And I think it's very, very complicated. The court didn't give guidance onto what happens to the embryos that are now frozen, and these clinics must decide what to do.
Thanks for the call, Tim. And Susan, we should talk through the IVF process briefly to see how this has an effect. Why are, if someone's somebody's going through in vitro fertilization, we end up with multiple embryos created, some frozen? Can you talk us through why that is?
Yeah, in the standard of care is to create embryos and to implant them. It's a difficult task to extract the eggs, et cetera. So the idea is to implant a certain number that could come to a pregnancy, and the others are reserved because it's not likely for it to take the first time. It is possible to have in vitro IVF without reserving frozen embryos, and there are other countries that do that. That was mentioned in one of the concurrences. There are ways for these clinics to adapt, but I should say that one in four married women in the United States, ages 15 to 49, without prior births, have difficulty getting pregnant, and IVF accounts for 1 to 2% of the nation's births annually. That's about 92,000 births. So this affects many people in the United States.
Talking to Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University about an Alabama State Supreme Court ruling on frozen embryos, saying in effect they are constitutionally children. Susan, this obviously has big implications for in vitro fertilization. You touched on earlier concerns that this potentially extending personhood to embryos, frozen or otherwise, could have a lot of big impacts way beyond fertilization and infertility treatment.
Yeah, I mean, this not only affects things like rape treatment, like Plan B, because any hormonal birth control that prevents pregnancy by blocking the implantation of a fertilized egg could be outlawed in Alabama. But this also affects the autonomy of anyone with a womb, and it potentially could reduce many women to second-class citizenship. If embryos have the same rights as all people, then pregnant people might be monitored by the government during their pregnancies. And this was a tension raised by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in the Casey case in 1992. She said it would be intolerable for women to be told you can't eat that food or you can't have that cigarette because somehow the state would have the right to protect an embryo or a fetus. This case, it's very hard to explain just how extreme it is in so many ways. Its language and also the ways in which it abuses this idea that we have that courts will, with a light hand, interpret the laws that are passed by the legislature. This is an 1872 law about wrongful death of minors. It never could have imagined frozen embryos in 1872, and that was pointed out by some of the justices who agreed with the majority opinion. So we have the creation of a precedent. This is what I think is important about Tim's question, that can be used by others now and quoted, and that's how our law works. One person says something, and then we see whether other courts will support it going forward.
That takes me to a big question. This is in Alabama for now. Do you think it's likely that similar challenges will be raised in other state court systems and or the federal court system?
We often focus on the rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court, but award-winning research by scholars at Penn State and WashU in St. Louis have demonstrated that state courts have a far greater impact on the lives of people. And this is a superb example. Citizens in all states should pay careful attention to proposed amendments to their state constitutions and any laws proposed that affect their liberty and rights as parents, pregnant people, or individuals. Right now, there isn't another state that has this combination of an 1872 act and a very recent amendment to the Constitution that declares the sanctity of life in Alabama. That is what the majority used, was this combination of something that the voters passed in 2018 and something that Dobbs turned into a different kind of amendment to their Constitution. It enabled them now to make this decision.
And very briefly, Susan, what are you watching for next in the aftermath of this ruling?
I'm going to be watching for the ways in which candidates for the presidency react to it. Nikki Haley said that frozen embryos are babies. I think that's very telling. I'm going to be watching for how the parties, how leaders in both parties in the Senate and the House speak about this, whether they treat it as something that is outside the pale, too much Christianity in the law, or too radical an idea. And also see if other states begin to pass amendments to their constitutions that try to preserve people's rights against a decision, something like this.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. She talked to us about the Alabama Supreme Court ruling effectively granting frozen embryos, especially those used in vitro fertilization, effective personhood. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Salads aren't always thought of as comfort food. Sure, maybe you get an awesome sweet or savory dressing that makes the leafy contents more fun, or you load up enough croutons that it feels like you're eating a sandwich with extra crusty bread. What if salad was a luxurious and satisfying meal? The Seinfeld character Elaine knew what she wanted when it came to salads. Here she is talking to a waitress in a 1994 episode called The Big Salad.
How about a big salad? A big salad? You see?
Just tell her what you want. They'll make it for you.
It's a salad, only bigger, with lots of stuff in it.
I can bring you two small salads.
Could you put it in a big bowl?
We don't have big bowls.
All right, just give me a cup of decaf.
We have Sanka.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Can salad be a meal for you? What goes into your salads? Are they the main event at your table? Or do you need some advice on making your salad bigger and more fun? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Kat Ashmore is the chef, recipe developer, and digital creator behind Kat Can Cook and the social media sensation of Hungry Lady Salads. Her new cookbook has those salads and a lot more. It's called Big Bites, wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. Kat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello. So good to be here with you.
Now, before we dig into the salads, that's just one chapter we're going to focus on here. But tell us a little bit about your approach to food. What I'm reading, I like it. It seems like a lot of fun. Tell us about it.
I don't believe in either or. I believe in more. And what that means is I don't think that you should have to choose between eating tortilla chips or eating lettuce. I think you can do it all. And so my approach is really about abundant, flavorful, nourishing food that just happens to be good for you. But most importantly, it's delicious. And it's stuff that hopefully your families will all enjoy. I like to make one meal for my families at dinner time. And that's really important to me, because I think as busy moms, we have enough to do. We don't need to be short order cooks.
And then reading through your recipe ingredients, I'm like, yeah, this is all pretty healthy stuff. But I think sometimes people think health food and it's like, what am I sacrificing? What am I leaving out? How much not fun am I going to have it? But your recipes, I'm looking at pictures of them. I'm looking at the final products. It sounds like really fun and satisfying.
They absolutely are. And, you know, my father used to say that you knew something was good for you because it didn't taste like anything. And so I took it as a personal challenge after culinary school to change his mind about that. And I think that my approach has served a lot of people really well, because we are looking at adding a lot of stuff to our meals. We're building a ton of flavor. So anytime we're cutting back on the sugar or cutting back on the fat, we are putting in flavor. And so no one is going to feel like they are sacrificing anything with these recipes.
Now, your Hungry Lady salad concept took off on TikTok, among other social media platforms. Could you talk about the origin of Hungry Lady salads and how they got so big?
Oh, yeah, the Hungry Lady salad. You know, I found myself, it was the first week of January in 2021, and I was kind of looking around. It was the new year, new you time, where everyone is thinking about, how can I drop a few pounds? How can I feel better in my clothes, have more energy, sleep better, all of those kinds of things. And it seemed to me that there were places to go if you wanted to be on a specific diet. Say you were paleo or keto, or you were practicing veganism. It was very obvious where you could go for those, that type of inspiration. And I found myself saying, but what about all of the people like me that just want to eat well, you know, that just want to eat better, that aren't going on a diet, they just want to eat better. So the Hungry Lady salad was my answer to that. And it felt like a space that I was very ready and capable of stepping into. And these were big salads, and are big salads that have a lot of stuff going on in them. They're going to keep you really satisfied throughout the afternoon. We're not talking about a piece of iceberg lettuce and a couple of old tomatoes. You know, these have a lot of layering, a lot of flavor, homemade dressings, and oftentimes you can meal prep them on a Sunday or a Monday and they will keep in the fridge all week.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Kat Ashmore. Her new cookbook is called Big Bites, Wholesome, Comforting Recipes That Are Big on Flavor, Nourishment, and Fun. We're going to focus on salads and her concept of Hungry Lady salads, a whole chapter in the book. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think of eating salad as a chore, a way just to get a little bit of green in that food? Or are you excited about salads? Do you put lots of cool stuff in them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kat, I will admit, you mentioned a homemade dressing that goes with all your salads here. I have this like weird mental block where I think, oh, homemade salad, that's super fancy and complicated. I know it isn't really. And in reading your recipes, that, you know, it would take like 30 seconds to make a lot of these dressings that you're making. Make the case for making our own dressings.
It makes all the difference in the world. I always say to people when they say, where should I start? I want to start cooking more in the kitchen. Where should I start? I say, make a salad dressing. That is something that is low effort, high reward every time. It's going to make dipping veggies into it more pleasurable. Oftentimes, you know, you can dunk everything from crispy chicken in there to pouring it over tacos or adding it to sandwiches as a spread. But really, it's utilizing the things that you already have on hand oftentimes, right? So great salad dressing, I look at it like a story. It's a cast of characters. Everyone is bringing out something else in the other characters involved, right? You've got spicy, sometimes sweet, salty, tangy, crunchy, acidic, and it all just works together.
You've shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/food. Let's check one out now. This one sounds great. Roasted cauliflower salad with sesame date dressing. You know, I like salad. I like roasted cauliflower. I don't really think about putting roasted cauliflower in a salad. Tell us about this recipe.
I love to hear that. That's usually what people say. Oh, wow. I never would have thought to do that. And that's what I love to do. I love to take ingredients and foods that are familiar, but just use them in a different way. So, you know, during the winter time, I think a lot of us still want to have those heartier dishes. And oftentimes that means components of the recipe that are cooked. So we have chickpeas in there for protein and fiber. We've got cauliflower that is roasted and caramelized. And then we've got the fresh green component. And the sesame date dressing is really, really spectacular. It's naturally sweetened with dates. You just whiz it all in a blender and you will impress yourself every time.
Now, I want to focus on something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned you're cooking for kids a lot. I'm a parent, and mostly my kids are pretty good about eating veggies, but there were some, you know, battles. How do your kids respond to these, you know, wild salads with all this stuff in them, including lots of veggies, obviously?
You know, it's hit or miss. Sometimes they will pick some stuff out of the salads and then just keep the stuff that they know that they like to eat, whether it's celery or cucumber or the lettuce, which I still consider a huge win. But I will tell you, sometimes I will make a salad dressing and a salad, and if they really like it, they will go back for 2-3 helpings of the salad. And I just turn to my husband and I say, I want every single family to experience this, because you know, nothing feels better than when your kid not only eats a nutritious meal, but goes back for second and third helpings.
Have you ever had the exact opposite experience? Because I've got, I mean, it's legendary. The day of I made celeriac slaw, you know, celery root.
Oh, yeah.
I found this recipe. Yeah. I didn't even like it that much. This is the only food ever where my kids, it hit their tongue and they spat it right out. It was so, so bad. Have you ever had that big fail with the kids?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have. Absolutely. I made a recipe last night, and William, my 7-year-old, his exact words to me were, "This is not your best work." Yes.
Oh,
not
wow.
Your best work. I know.
Is he watching cooking shows or something? That sounds like a bad review from not like Gordon Ramsay, but.
You know. I mean, it's pretty hilarious. And he's like, I'm sorry. It's true. It's not your best work. And, you know, he was kind of right. It's a recipe that I'm testing for my next cookbook. And, you know, I always say, yes, I worked for Martha Stewart, but the hardest critics I've ever had are my kids.
All right. Let's get back into some salad ingredients. One tip, you've got some secret weapons that you have in the kitchen. One of them is one of my favorite, quick pickled red onions. For people who haven't done this, talk us through how to quick pickle a red onion and what we're going to do with it.
Oh, they're so good, aren't they? Yeah. They are just, these secret weapons, I call them, are these little flavor bomb condiments that you have in the fridge that just add so much depth and flavor to anything you put them on. So they're really beautiful because we're using red onions. So you get that really pretty, like bright pink magenta color as they start to pickle. And you just do a really quick pickling brine, which has to have some kind of acid, a little bit of sugar, and then water at its most basic sense, some salt as well. I like to add pink peppercorn sometimes, some herbs, but you can keep it super simple. And then you just add that hot liquid that you have brought down a little bit to like a warm temperature to the onions. And then you just put them in your fridge and you give it some time and let them do their thing. And they will be really, really bright and tart and a little bit sweet. And they're great on everything from burgers to tacos to egg salad, scrambled eggs, you name it.
Kat Ashmore is with us sharing some of her best work. It's Food Friday. We're getting into the Hungry Lady salads and more from her new cookbook. That cookbook is called Big Bites, wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to make boring salads less boring? Are you a big salad fan yourself? Do you do salad as the meal ever? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, find a couple recipes from Kat at WPR.org/food. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Kat Ashmore, chef, recipe developer, and digital creator. It's Food Friday. We're talking about Kat's popular Hungry Lady salads. You can find those salads and more in her new cookbook called Big Bites, wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Don is with us in Bayfield County. Hi there, Don.
Hey, Don here. Say, when I grew up, I'm 65 years old, and my parents never bought any salad dressing. from the stores. They always make their homemade.
And did you have favorites you remember, Don?
Italian, mm-hmm. olive oil, vinegar.
Sounds great, Don. Thanks for sharing that. And a
you
good
have
salad
some
dressing.
Smart parents. Yeah. You have some smart parents.
And a salad dressing can be that easy, right? Olive oil, a little vinegar, maybe a little bit of spices, and you got yourself a dressing.
Yep. I think we tend to overcomplicate it. There's no need. I love it.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Don. Jessica is with us now in Mauston. Jessica, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm just curious what her thoughts are on the keto diet. So I am 48. I am in early stages of menopause because of a hysterectomy. So I've been very strict on sugars and carbs, and I find it very hard to regulate my weight and still keep a healthy diet. I eat a lot of fruits, and what carbs I do eat are first thing in the morning. So I just like to hear her thoughts on that.
Jessica, thanks for the call. Now, Kat, you briefly mentioned keto, but saying your focus is not on a particular diet. I'm not that familiar with keto myself. Do you have thoughts on things that Jessica can do to make a keto diet, I don't know, more fun, interesting, tasty, and maybe still healthy?
I do. You know, I think that there are varying levels of these diet plans. So if you're doing strict keto, then that means no fruits, very little vegetables. I mean, it's almost bordering on the carnivore diet. It doesn't sound like that's the kind of thing you're following, which I think is great news. You know, ultimately, I think in order to be consistent with anything, you have to find a way to enjoy it. And like my recipes, for instance, you will find a lot of my recipes are low carb, not intending to be low carb, but just naturally low carb because of the fact that we are really celebrating a lot of produce, you know, beautiful vegetables. We're celebrating a lot of different kinds of proteins. So these recipes are more naturally low carb when they are low carb, but I think you're going to find that there is a ton of stuff that is still going to work for you.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jessica. And Kat, getting back to the philosophy of your, not just salads, but your whole cookbook, you're not saying I'm following one path and like these really strict rules. There's a lot of moderation, but there's a lot of room to play around with different stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my salads, you're topping it. It's the barbecue ranch chop salad, and you're topping it, I mean, not only with barbecued beans, but with tortilla chips. So it is truly not choosing between chips and salad. I mean, sometimes we're even eating them together.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Kat Ashmore on this edition of Food Friday. Her new book is called Big Bites, Wholesome, Comforting Recipes That Are Big on Flavor, Nourishment, and Fun. We're mainly focusing on the chapter about her hungry lady salads. Back to your calls. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Mark?
Hi. I just tuned in, and I'm making a salad now, actually. I've been a vegan for 39 years, and so I make a salad pretty much every night. And I've been experimenting with, instead of using your normal store-bought dressing, I've been experimenting with putting things like cinnamon and just sprinkling water on top. But my key, I think, is to have the crunch in the salad. So I always throw beets in, peanuts, sunflower seeds, cucumbers, tomatoes, and all that stuff, raisins. And so a lot of my salad is not just the lettuce and spinach and whatever I throw in, but the crunchy stuff.
Mark, thanks a lot. Yeah, I love having, can't get enough of that crunchy stuff in salads, Kat. What are your other favorite crunch ingredients?
I agree. I'm big on the crunch, that's for sure. Well, I just mentioned tortilla chips, which is kind of fun, but it's not a staple. There are inherently crunchy vegetables, which I will add almost primarily for the sake of crunch, things like, you know, bell peppers or some celery or fennel or things like that. But I love to do toasted nuts. I think also using toasted walnuts in a salad dressing is really lovely. You just blend it in the blender with everything else and you've got a little bit of texture still. It's nice and creamy. Doing different kinds of seeds, absolutely. But even doing something like a savory granola or some crispy chickpeas that you just toss on a baking sheet with a little olive oil and salt. I can make pretty much anything crispy. I think crispy is a great texture to have in a salad.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. Nancy joins us now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello, hello. I very much like the taste of sweet sour pickled beets. And I noticed that in the supermarkets, they cost quite a bit more than ordinary canned beets. So I'm wondering if I can buy the cheaper canned beets, pour off that liquid, and put on some kind of a brine to turn them into pickled beets. And do you have such a brine that I could very quickly make?
Well, and Nancy, let me, before we throw this to Kat, would you be open to, you know, buying beets, cutting them up and pickling them? That's you can quick pickle those in the fridge. Oh, I think we lost Nancy. Okay, Kat, your thoughts on either converting canned beets or taking fresh beets and turning them into pickled beets?
I would say 100% you are going to be spending more money the more work that they are doing for you. So I would do a very similar brine as my pickled onions. That is a universal, you know, pickling brine. So as long as you've got some kind of vinegar in there, I usually just use a plain white wine vinegar. You can do apple cider and a little bit of sugar, a little bit of salt. You're going to be good to go. Water, of course. It's actually quite simple. Once you know how to pickle one vegetable, you know how to pickle them all.
Nancy, good luck to you. I'm nuts about pickled beets. So I'm right there with you, Nancy.
Yeah.
Rolf joins us now in Boyceville. Rolf, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment on how a guy that has never cooked and does a salad once in a while.
Ooh,
what's your secret,
you?
Rolf?
I take one head of romaine lettuce, chop it up on a cutting board until I can eat it with a spoon, and I take about 6 whole mushrooms, chop those up, put them on a dinner plate, and then I warm up 1 cup full of spicy hot chili and dump it on top, and I eat it.
Excellent. That's...
I love it. That sounds hearty.
Rolf, thanks for that. That's pretty outside the box, mixing chili into a salad, Kat. I don't know if I saw anything in exactly that neighborhood in your collection of salads.
Very creative. I mean, the closest thing would be the barbecue beans on the barbecue ranch salad. So that's not too far away.
Thanks a lot, Rolf, for the call. Oh, I want to check out, before we run out of time, Kat, the other recipe you shared with us. We had that roasted cauliflower salad. Now we've got this shaved Caesar salad with fennel and crispy chickpeas.
Yes, I love this one so much. It is very near and dear to my heart. I think everyone loves a Caesar salad. Almost everyone loves a Caesar salad. So I knew that I had to have a rendition of a Caesar salad in here. The fennel adds some nice crunch. It adds a little bit of that anise flavor, which kind of just makes it feel a little bit more sophisticated. And then the crispy chickpeas are a brilliant way to get a bit of crunch and to get some protein if you don't want to add something like chicken. Though, honestly, you could just throw chicken on this as well, too, and it would be delightful.
Now, just our last few moments, Kat, I know you're constantly experimenting with new recipes. What is in your laboratory right now?
Oh, so at the moment, I am working on, I'm calling it an Italian stuffed cabbage soup. So it's got lots of ground beef and garlic and tomatoes and rice and cabbage and Parmesan. It's really, really hearty and really delicious. I think that'll probably be in my next book.
Excellent, Kat. We'll talk to you again when that comes out. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sounds great. Loved being with you. Thank you.
That's Kat Ashmore, the chef, recipe developer, and digital creator behind Kat Can Cook. And we talked to her today on this week's edition of Food Friday about Hungry Lady Salads that come from her new cookbook. It's called Big Bites. Wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. You could find 2 of those salads at WPR.org/food. The shaved Caesar salad with fennel and crispy chickpeas we were just talking about, plus the roasted cauliflower salad with sesame date dressing. Again, find those at WPR.org/food. And if you have any favorite salad secrets to share, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Also, it's almost here. Our winter member drive is just around the corner. This year, it's happening in one action-packed day. We're on a mission to keep the interruptions to a minimum while reaching our fundraising target, but we can't do it alone. Your gift right now makes a difference. You'll keep this one-day drive a success and ensure access to trustworthy news and conversations into the future. You can give right now. WPR.org/donate. Yesterday, we talked to the author of a new book about nostalgia and how it can be a positive force in our lives. You shared some nostalgia stories. Here's another one. Adam in Oshkosh emails, I had a nostalgic memory last week triggered by a smell. I was in the feed store and was instantly transported back to my childhood when I spent some time at my grandparents' dairy farm. The smell was of the milk house. Don't know if it's a cleaner or a mixture of cleaners and grain smell, but it was a vivid memory. Great conversation today. Adam, thanks. There is something about smells, right, and nostalgia. I get a weird one with a smell that isn't so great, the smell of stale cigarette smoke and spilled beer. My band used to play a lot in bars around the state back before the indoor smoking ban. We'd get there to load in, usually before the bar and club was open or before it got busy. There's that unique smell of last night's cigarettes and beer soaked into the floor. It is not a good smell, but it has strong associations with those days. If I smell something like that, I'm instantly taken back to load-in time, carrying gear, getting ready for a set. Do I miss the smoke? Not so much. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The latest numbers say the economy is doing pretty well when it comes to big picture numbers like employment, the stock market, and wages. Even inflation has slowed down. But many Americans continue to express concern and dissatisfaction with their own financial situation. You may have seen headlines like one from The Economist, "Why are Americans so gloomy about their great economy?" Our next guest found that a lot of people have some pretty good reasons to be uncertain about the economy and how it affects them. She's been talking to people all over the country about their economic concerns. Earlier this week, she co-wrote a piece in the New York Times about why, as the headline says, many Americans believe the economy is rigged. She joins us now to share what she found. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you see news about the economy, do you feel like it reflects your own experience? What are your concerns when it comes to how the economy affects you? Do you feel precarious? Maybe things are okay right now, but you're not far from a big problem, potentially. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kathy Kramer is professor of political science at UW-Madison, co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. Kathy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's great to be here.
Well, sometimes when I look at coverage of this issue, the economy looks good, big picture, people express discontent, there's almost a hint that, well, what's wrong with people? Why aren't they understanding the economy is good? You found, as you talk to people, a lot of good reasons for that.
Yeah, and one big one is that when we ask how is the economy doing, we often use these big indicators like levels of unemployment or inflation that are pretty far removed from people's lives. And what people see is the prices they're paying, right, or the level of credit card debt they have. And so we just went around the country and convened these small groups of people and listened to them and asked them, what are your challenges and what are you experiencing?
I want to talk a little more about the project that you did here. You were literally going around the country. Set the scene for us. How are you getting people together? How do these conversations shake out?
Well, the whole commission was organized around the idea that we needed to think about how well the American people are doing, aside from how well the economy is doing, to try to recommend things that would help create an economy where people, more people, a wide range of people can thrive. And we decided that one great way to figure out what to do was to listen to people. So people on the commission, some staff from the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, some great undergraduate students right here from UW-Madison helped us out in facilitating these conversations where we asked questions that were based on this platform that I've helped develop with this nonprofit called Cortico. The platform is called Fora, and the idea is you just ask people big questions like, what are your concerns? What do you hope for? What do you wish would be different about your life 5 years from now? And what do you want people in power to hear about the challenges that you're facing? So there was a wide range of people in many corners of the country.
Now, you shared actual audio of some of the responses you got. And I want to listen to one of these now. We've got a teacher you talked to in rural Tennessee. Here it is.
I just said I was at my fullest potential, like, you know, 5 minutes ago, and I'm still like, you know, one doctor's visit away from not being there. And pretty much most people I know are.
So one doctor's visit away from not being in good shape economically. This is something I've heard over the years. The idea that people feel precarious. It may not even matter where they are on the income scale. One big change could put somebody into potentially poverty.
Yeah. And that the idea of like when you wonder, when are people going to feel like the economy is good and when they're doing well in the economy? Basically, people just are looking for some level of stability, right? Some ability to plan, to save. And for lots of folks, that's just not possible. They're on a weekly, monthly basis struggling to make ends meet, and they just don't have the bandwidth to really save or plan, much less, you know, make ends meet sometimes. So, you know, her statement in the end, she's saying, like, I'm one doctor's visit away from disaster, and most people I know are. It's common, right? She's at the same time talking about, I just a moment ago said I'm at kind of at the peak of my economic well-being, and yet I feel like I'm on the edge of disaster.
And beyond the obvious, like, economic impact, if you have that doctor's visit that wipes out all your economic gains, I want to quote from your piece here. An absence of economic resilience prevents people from spending time with family, from getting involved in their community, and from finding ways to build a safety net. So it's not just the obvious problem of you run out of money, but this follow-on effect that hurts us as a society.
Yeah. And so we asked people, you know, what would a good economy look like? And people just want, like you said, time with their family. They want a little bit of time to do something other than work. They want time to just be well in whatever way they define that. And our economy currently, that's not what it's built for. It's not built for the average American's well-being.
Kathy Kramer is with us from UW-Madison, political scientist there. She's been involved in a research project talking to actual people about how they experience the economy. You can join in with your response to some of the things you're hearing now at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say that I believe that the politicians in Madison and Washington are so far removed from reality. They seem to be passing all kinds of legislation that's in favor of large corporations, huge tax breaks, and the working class people are still struggling to make ends meet. And it doesn't seem like there's any connection with the politicians about what people are going through every day just to earn a living.
Damn.
And I don't think the politicians could live on $15 an hour themselves. I'd like to see them do that.
Daryl, thank you so much for the call. This echoes, I think, a lot of what you've heard, Kathy.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Daryl. That was a pretty widespread sentiment. And it might interest you to know that one of our recommendations was actually to foster training for working class folks so they can run for office and have their views in the mix and have their experiences part of the policymaking, because there are very few people of working class background serving in any level of government in the United States right now.
Thanks a lot for that call, Daryl. Flipping things around, are you hoping that politicians and other decision makers take something away from the conversations you've had with people around the country?
Definitely. And I'm happy to say that when you having an op-ed in the New York Times helps get a little bit of notice. And so it is sparking some conversations with policymakers. And we're not in the business of lobbying with this report, and that's not what the American Academy of Arts and Sciences does. But we hope that what we heard can be informative to people in policy making power, right? So that they can learn from what we heard.
Thanks again for that call, Daryl. And here's another clip from one of the people you talked to. This is somebody in Kentucky, I think with some of the same themes as Daryl. Here's a listen.
I just feel like the underdog can't get ahead, and it's all about greed and profit.
And in your New York Times piece, it seems like that greed theme came through loud and clear for you.
It really did, because one of the questions we asked people was, what values do you think drive the economy? And almost always people said, I'm sorry to laugh, but people said without skipping a beat, well, greed, you know, the profit motive. And the values driving our economy are not, you know, what can we do to make sure all people thrive in this country? Instead, people talked a lot about greed.
Now, I almost pulled a clip from the movie Wall Street, the famous Michael Douglas's Gordon Gekko, his greed is good speech. I mean, there's a political and economic argument that says greed is good. It drives innovation. It's something that a rising tide lifts all boats eventually. I mean, did people confront that kind of thinking that, hey, freeing up rich people to get richer may have a benefit for everybody?
There definitely were conversations about growth. Like, isn't growth a good thing, and doesn't that help everybody out in the end? And sometimes people connected that to greed, but I'd say more often a question of does growth have to be about greed? Mm-hmm. You know, can't we find a way to create jobs that actually help communities thrive in terms of enabling people to do work that's meaningful to them, that allows them to live their values as opposed to crushing their soul.
And then on the opposite end, I think, of the political spectrum, the argument is, hey, if everybody feels precarious economically, we need a stronger social safety net. Did people talk in those terms at all when you talked to them?
Not so much, to be honest. I mean, at times, but it was more a kind of bewilderment with the system as a whole. It was sort of disgruntlement with employers, with mm-hmm. the banking system, not just with government and what the government is or is not providing. Mm-hmm. Just so when people told us that they thought the system was rigged, they're not just talking about politicians. They're talking about the private sector and many different sectors of the country.
Kathy Kramer is with us, professor of political science at UW-Madison, co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. She's with us for a look at how Americans are feeling about the economy. She's just written up a long-term project talking to people around the country about how the economy impacts them, why they may feel a mismatch between the good numbers you see in the headlines and their realities. Join in at 800-642-1234 to share your perspective on this. When you see positive reports about the economy, low unemployment numbers, Wall Street looking pretty good, a stock market going up, inflation finally tapering off, do you feel that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with UW-Madison political scientist Kathy Kramer about why Americans feel like the economy is not great for them. They feel precarious despite sunny reports and many economic indicators. She's been talking to people all around the country about their personal, their family economies. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your report on how you feel about the economy, if you feel like things are stable or things are precarious for your economic future. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Bethany is with us in Durand. Bethany, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Bethany?
So I think one of the things being middle class that I've noticed with the economy is that the things that we're often doing for pleasure, especially with our family, going out to eat, buying, you know, chips or some snack foods, going out to a concert, those things are now becoming out of reach for middle class. You go to McDonald's, and for a family of four, it's over $30. And meanwhile, these companies are making record profits. And it's really discouraging.
Bethany, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy, again, yeah. This is the kind of thing you're hearing.
Yeah, I mean, I know you can't see me, Bethany, but I'm nodding my head as you're talking. And yeah, we heard that a lot, and that perception of, you know, how can it be tough for me to buy a bag of chips for my family when clearly there's lots of wealth in this country, right? It's difficult for people to square. And so that's just another reason why it's not a mystery that people don't think the economy is doing great, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it may be doing great in the abstract, but in our own personal lives, not so much.
Thanks for that call. I want to listen to another person you talked to. This one's an HR employee in Indiana talking about, you know, and this is something I think you heard from a lot of people. You don't need to be rich, but what does financial well-being sound like? Here's a listen.
Financial well-being is, for me, is basically being able to take care of my everyday expenses and also having like emergency savings, because the way the economy is going right now, you don't know where it's going to be, you know, tomorrow, next week. So yeah, it's basically about being financially stable. It's not about being rich, but it's about being able to take care of your everyday needs without, you know, stressing.
Okay, a lot in there, Kathy.
Yeah, I mean, that level of uncertainty, right? Like in any aspect of our lives, when we experience uncertainty, I mean, it can turn to anxiety, right? And it's this undertone of worry that makes life a little bit more tough, a little less enjoyable. And that lack of a cushion is just very common for lots of folks.
Thanks again for that call. Mike joins us now in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The Wisconsin state unemployment system, the amount that it pays people who get laid off or let go from work is historically at a very low level. It doesn't keep up with the rent payments or the payments for gas and cell phone bills. I don't think they've changed the amounts in 20 or 30 years. And if you take a look at the surrounding states, Wisconsin's maximum unemployment compensation is roughly half of what it is for Minnesota. And it just creates a spiraling effect where people can't pay their bills, they've been let go, and then they're counting on the safety net, and the safety net isn't there for them.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Kathy?
Yeah, we definitely heard a lot about that, and we heard a lot about how, two things about the safety nets that are in place. One, you know, people feeling like they're not set up to really get people back on their feet, much less help them thrive. And a lot of times there's what people call these cliff effects, where if you start to earn a little bit more and suddenly you're bumped off of unemployment benefits or bumped off of welfare or, housing support, it's, a lot of the safety net programs are difficult to navigate and not what a lot of people feel like they would need to really have a stable footing and get back on their feet and get ahead, you know, much less get ahead. Yeah.
Thanks for that call, Mike. On a related note, here's one of the participants you talked to in Chicago about where you were just talking about making too much money, maybe getting knocked off a program.
It's like you can get the benefits if you're living at or below the poverty line, right? And we know that number is seriously low. But for the people such as myself who are the working class, it knocks me out of a lot of the opportunity to qualify for a lot of the programs that could assist in benefiting myself and my child in order for us to make ends meet. And that is, you know, a huge barrier.
Is this part of a solution here, Kathy? I know some programs taper, like I think the Earned Income Tax Credit and some other things, health subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. I mean, yeah. Is that part of a solution instead of yes or no, a gradation?
Yeah, just having these cutoffs where just earning one more dollar overnight bumps you off. It's not working for people.
Thanks a lot for the call. Back to our callers. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with greed. If it wasn't for greed, we wouldn't have the economy that we do today. And being a landlord, I see so many tenants that scam the system. They collect benefits and they work besides. And I've got other renters that they just do the very minimum they can do to get by, and then they complain that they're not getting enough. You know, everybody's different. If somebody wants to make it, I always had two jobs in my life. And I just don't have a lot of sympathy for people that aren't making ends meet.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Did you hear that that pushback from some of the people you talked to?
I suppose a bit. But as the caller was saying, everybody's different and is going to view these issues differently. But I wonder, you know, people who maybe be worthwhile if more tenants and landlords had the opportunity to listen to one another. Mm-hmm. I bet it's pretty rare.
Thanks, Dave, for calling in. Victoria is with us in Marinette. Victoria, hi.
Hi. My comment was that I'm 69 years old, and my comment was that we got along just fine with a regular telephone. You know, we paid our doctor bills. We didn't have insurance. And, you know, we didn't have to go to football games that cost, you know, $150 a ticket. You know, we kind of brought this situation on ourselves.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Is this something about our changing expectations? But then again, doctor's visits cost a lot more than they used to, Kathy.
Yeah, well, it's a great question that we both, just what we want to consume has changed over time for sure, as have housing prices and the cost of a lot of goods that we need. And that the sentiment of, you know, things used to be different is common. I mean, people definitely spoke a lot about how it used to be easier to get by.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kathy, in just our last little less than a minute now, what's one takeaway, again, that you're hoping policymakers get out of your work here?
Honestly, to listen more. It's kind of expensive in a way because it takes time and you have to give people the opportunity to reflect. You have to give them your time. But it's remarkable what you learn when you just pause and invite people to share their concerns and their challenges and their hopes. I'm speaking to the choir here on WPR. Thank you very much. But I hope they listen.
Kathy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's always an honor.
Kathy Kramer is a professor of political science at UW-Madison and co-chair of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences Commission on Reimagining Our Economy. We've been talking about her research into our attitudes on the economy and why many Americans she interviewed feel like the economy is not in their favor in spite of the positive headlines you might see about the economy. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we can have very special relationships with people who aren't our romantic partners. That's the message from the author of the new book, The Other Significant Others. And there's a lot of concern lately about kids not showing up for school. We'll find out how big a problem that is lately and look at efforts by schools and the state government to try to tackle that issue. That and more, all coming up Monday here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.